Good morning, happy Sunday, and happy Mother's Day. Welcome to On the Weekend Edition. I am your host, Brian Pettaway, and like every Sunday, I'll be with you here again today for about an hour. Sometimes I go a little over, and I apologize for that. But there's so much to talk about, especially this weekend. There's so much going on in the world, and I've got great guests today. Not just one, but two who are going to sit down with me and talk about one of the hottest topics today, and that is the writer's strike in Hollywood. Now, I know if you've been paying attention, you recognize this is not the first time that this has happened, but each and every time there is a writer's strike or an actor strike, it literally shuts Hollywood down. I mean, production stop. So I've got two writers here who write for these shows who are on strike right now, who's going to tell us what this strike means to them and what it should mean to us. And of course, I've got the Petty, and the Petty's going to talk about a multitude of things in the sports world, just not football today. And I can't wait to get to him. But first, you got me. And the first thing I want to talk about, well, is Mother's Day, because it is Mother's Day. I wondered, where did Mother's Day start? Like, how did this start? I used to think that it started in church, you know, because you had Women's Day, you had Men's Day, you had, you know, Young Adult Day. And I thought, well, Mother's Day, it had to start with church, right? Well, it didn't. I did a little digging, a little research, and most historians believe that civilization's earliest celebrations of motherhood occurred in ancient Greece during a festival honoring the mother of the gods, Rhea, who was considered a symbol of female fertility, motherhood, and the passing of one generation to another. Now, these jubilant festivals were typically held in the spring months, like March and April, and involved parades and large party-like gatherings and, you know, lots of food. As time went on and things evolved, including science, and the practice of celebrating the gods kind of dissipated, even in ancient Greece, the importance of motherhood and the celebration of it never did stop. And from the ancient celebrations of honoring different goddesses to the modern Mother's Day holiday here in the U.S., one tradition holds true across the board, and that is the gift of flowers. And this stems from the fact that flowers have been used as universal signs of love and appreciation for thousands and thousands of years. Flowers have always symbolized love, appreciation, and beauty, the very traits most typically associated with motherhood. They are signs of life and birth and rebirth. And experts say that giving flowers encompasses countless feelings and emotions. Everything from gestures of gratitude and indebtedness to recognition for years and years of love and sacrifice. Bottom line is, if you are blessed to still have your mother here with you, you can take her to dinner and you can get her a card, but get your mama some flowers. And here's a fun fact. Americans spent a total of $31.7 billion on Mother's Day celebrations last year. $31.7 billion. And, you know, just for fun, I wanted to see what we spent on Father's Day last year. And, you know, as a father, I'm a little hurt. You know what I'm saying? I mean, you guys spent $31.7 billion on mothers. You spent a little less than $20 billion on your dads. I mean, look, we were there. No doubt. We were there. It couldn't have happened without us. So y'all got to do better on Father's Day. But today is Mother's Day. Happy Mother's Day to all of the mothers out there listening today. And hey, for the mothers like mine who are no longer with us, hey, you never stop celebrating your mother. This day is for them as well. All right, so I want to get to the show. I want to start talking about a couple of things that I talked about last week. The first one in the news is Donald Trump. Donald Trump has actually been found guilty of something in a courthouse, you guys. Like, he was found guilty of sexually abusing E. Jean Carroll, who was the columnist who said that she was raped by him 27 years ago. Now, the jury did not find him guilty of rape. What they found him guilty of was sexual abuse and charged him to pay her $5 million. Now, this is a civil court case, so there is no jail time that's pending for him. But remember, there is a criminal case that's going on involving Trump just two blocks away from the courthouse that he was found guilty of here. And that is not going well for him either. All of the evidence that he has been trying to suppress, apparently, especially cell phone evidence in this case, that Trump's attorneys were really trying to get the judge to suppress so that the jury would not hear, is all going to be heard. And according to prosecutors, that's the smoking gun. And remember, this is a criminal trial. There is actual jail time possible attached to these charges if he's found guilty. So I'm so eager to see what comes of this trial. And New York Representative George Santos pleaded not guilty on Wednesday after being arrested on 13 federal charges, including counts of wire fraud, money laundering, theft of public funds, and lying about pretty much everything to the U.S. House. Now, following his arraignment, the Republican lawmaker said he won't resign from Congress and plans to run for re-election. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy finally spoke up and said that he won't support his re-election, and if the Ethics Committee found that he broke the law, he would call for Santos to resign. Santos was released on a $500,000 bond, but he was also told to surrender his passport. Santos is delusional, y'all. Santos knows that he's going to jail, and my fear, honestly, is that he's going to take his life before he even gets to that point. There's something wrong with the guy. Also, there's a trend going on, and it's not a very good one. Stores like Nordstrom and Walmart, Whole Foods, Starbucks, CVS, these stores are closing doors in urban areas. These big chains and others have closed stores in major U.S. cities recently, raising alarms about the future of retail in some of the country's most prominent downtowns. Now, they cite several reasons for these, including online shopping, and very high and expensive leasing and rent rates. But store officials are also saying one of the biggest reasons that they're closing doors where they're closing them is because of crime and public safety concerns. And they're having a very difficult time keeping their workers safe and hiring new workers. And the last story I want to talk about is Title 42. Now, this is a big deal, and I'm going to tell you why it's a big deal. There are a lot of migrants currently at the border waiting to come into this country. And they've been there camped out, anticipating the expiration of this Title 42. Now, Title 42 was issued during the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic. It allowed authorities to swiftly turn away migrants at the U.S. border. And that was to prevent the spread of the coronavirus. But that changed Thursday night when the public health emergency in Title 42 lapsed. It expired. Well, now those same migrants who were turned away, often being deprived of their chance to claim asylum, are now back. And that sounds like a win for the migrants. But here's the other thing that Title 42 provided. It carried almost no legal consequences for migrants crossing, meaning if they were pushed back, they could try to cross again into the country multiple times without any legal consequence. Well, now that 42 has lifted, the U.S. government is returning to decades-old sections of U.S. code known as Title 8, which Homeland Security has warned carries far more severe consequences for migrants found to be entering the country without legal basis. So the border is a very hot spot right now. It's like a powder keg, and we need to be keeping our eye on what's going on down there. Now, as I mentioned when the show started, there is a writer strike. The WGA, the Writers Guild of America strike, is going on as we speak, and it's really making people nervous. I don't know if you remember, but in 2007 and 8, there was another strike just like this, and it really made people nervous. People like Jay Leno, and at the time, Conan O'Brien and David Letterman were in a panic. Because although those guys are funny presenting their monologues, those monologues aren't written by them. They are written by funnier people than they are. And when they didn't have that material coming in, the show could not go on. It's the equivalent of having an airport full of pilots, but no planes. I mean, I'm not just talking about late night hosts. I'm talking about sitcoms and dramas, movies. All of these things come to a screeching halt when writers decide that they're not going to write. They are the hidden jewel in Hollywood, and they're asking for, among other things, more respect. Now, like a lot of things, there's a lot to unpack here. Now, the 2023 Writers Guild of America strike, which is going on right now, the WGA, it's the largest interruption to American television and film production since the COVID-19 pandemic in 2020, as well as the largest labor stoppage for the WGA since that very first strike that I spoke about, 2008-2007. Now, I don't understand a lot about this stuff. I am not a writer in Hollywood. I write for my show, and I know how difficult that is, and I'm writing for me. I can't imagine what it's like every week to have to write for someone else to deliver your material and hope that they like it and that they deliver it well. I can't even imagine what that pressure is like. Fortunately, however, I don't have to imagine. I have two writers from Hollywood with me today, and they are here to help me unpack all of the questions that I have for them, and hopefully you have too, and explain exactly what they're looking for from this strike. So 1500 family, please help me welcome to On the Weekend Edition, Christian Jordan Greer and Darren Dorch. All right, Christian, Darren, thanks for joining me today. How you guys doing?
Doing very well. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, doing fantastic.
It's my pleasure. Absolutely. I really appreciate you guys' time. Listen, let me ask you a question. Being out in Hollywood as you are, what's the weather like out there right now?
Oh my God! It's actually quite nice right now. Clear sky,
but perfect.
We've been going through like these torrential rainfalls, but it's starting to clear up now. It's back to its normal self.
Well, you know, I'm here in Baltimore now. Christian, you're actually from Baltimore, right? As small as the world is, as it is. Now, I had your mom on the show a few months ago talking about Roberta's house, so it is a very, very small world, actually. So,
yes, very much.
let me ask you a question. How did you, Christian, go from the family business that you grew up in to wanting to be in film?
Yeah, you know what? Actually, I grew up always wanting to be in entertainment ever since I was a kid. It was kind of like I kind of knew around when I was 8 years old. It actually got first started off with acting, but I think as I grew up, I started getting into writing story as a kid, and writing actually at home was my way of therapy in my own way, and I kind of grew into writing more and more often, and it was also my best way to explain, you know, a complicated household that I lived in. So as I got older, I realized that this therapeutic alleyway I've always been doing can start to make a business out of it. I started actually to see a path of me becoming top of the top in writing by going that route versus when acting. So I leaned into writing more, and I've had a hell of a time doing it. I just can't stop writing. So,
hey man, if you got it, you know what I mean? It is what it is.
Exactly.
What about you, Darren? Now, you're out of St. Louis?
Yeah.
Okay, and then you went to what? I believe Webster's, right? You graduated from Webster's with a BA.
Yeah.
All right.
Yep.
What was your inspiration?
Inspiration. I mean, so it was funny. Like when I was younger, when I was around five or six, I mean, I loved to watch really like adult films. So I would watch things like Halloween, The Silence of the Lambs, Showgirls, Basic Instinct. Okay. And I mean, I also really liked comedies as well on television.
Okay.
Sitcoms. So I would watch Roseanne and Living Single, Martin, like, et cetera. So that sort of shaped me into wanting to do this.
So now you guys have both written short films, is that right?
Oh I started doing short films probably when I was 16 years old, and I was making short films all up until about senior year of college. So that was back in 2015 for me.
But how do you know you're good? Like how, you know what I mean? Like how do you know? I mean, I've always had this fear of failure and rejection, right? To put yourself out there with your most inner feelings and your creativity, and to present it to people, and I don't mean just like one or two people. But like to have your whole future hinging on people's acceptance, like that doesn't freak you out? That didn't scare you at 16?
I think there's a point in your career, especially when you're starting out, is that you don't really care if you're good or bad. You just want to make it happen. If you can put out the final product and you see that product after all that blood, sweat, and tears, it's like hours and hours and hours of putting that stuff together. Once you see it, you feel very proud of yourself. And there's a part of you that really doesn't care if it's good or bad. You just know it's the start of becoming good.
Okay.
And that's all that really fucking matters at the beginning.
I got you. Now, Darren, were your parents behind you in this venture?
They were. I mean, they, you know, being from the Midwest, I mean, it's expected that you just go to school and get a normal gig, you know, a cop,
right, exactly.
A doctor, or at a grocery store, something like that. But I, even when I was really young, everybody knew that I could, like, really, really write. So, like, I was always in, like, honors, like, English,
right.
Like, AP, and whatnot. So when I decided to do this, they were like, all right, well, let's do it. Like, I was always a really good student, so I always worked very, very hard. So, and I mean, I'm one of those people, I didn't come from money, so I always felt like I don't really have shit to lose, so let's fucking do it. So that's just always been my kind of like attitude.
Okay,
so
you leave the Midwest, and Christian, you leave the East, right, and the Southeast, and you go out to L.A., and you both decide that you're going to write for I mean, did you make a decision that you're going to write for other shows, or were you just picked up as writers for other shows? How does it even work? How do you decide, I'm going to write for shows and comedies and dramedies and stuff like that and make money?
So, So I will tell you. So I always started out at first thinking that, I'm going to get in the first being this really, like, R-rated indie film maker guy. But, like, it was interesting. When I got out of college, I really, really fell in love with the television. And okay. The shows on at the time were, like, shows like 30 Rock. And I, like, loved, like, that, like, always Sunny. So when I moved out to L.A., I started writing TV spec scripts. I was in, like, a writer's group and taking workshops and right. Shooting things. And I was like, I really like this. Like, this is dope. And I'm like, I think I want to get my start in the TV side. Plus, also, the money writing for the television is really, really good, too. So right. That didn't hurt either.
And I want to talk about the money in a little bit. I mean, I really want to talk about the money in a little bit because that's very, very important here. But I also wanted to ask, Christian, when you got out to L.A., did you already know someone? Did someone say, come on out here, we got a gig for you? Or did you go out there with, like, a lot of actors, wait tables, and then wait for your break?
I hit the ground running. I didn't really have a plan until I got here. I think one thing I really want to pat myself on the back when I first got out here is that I actually used my high school alumni. Well, let me back up a bit. I didn't get accepted to any colleges. So I came out here 18, no plan, like, I don't know what the fuck I'm doing. But I was really smart enough back then to utilize my high school alumni to see who was in the industry. And I actually reached out to that person through Facebook when it was very easy to find certain people on Facebook and message them. And we ended up, he actually invited me to his studio warehouse, which turned out to be a guy named Guillermo del Toro's post-production house. And he's the guy that did Pan's Labyrinth, and he also was working on Pacific Rim at that time.
Okay.
So I was very lucky enough to hit the ground running working in post-production. That being said, I wanted to be a writer, and I was in post-production. So I had a very long journey of just trying to get my foot working for a TV writer. And that just meant years and years and years of building relationships. And one of those relationships was a lovely woman by the name of Jean Chimerbois, who at that time was working for Criminal Minds. And okay. It was just 8 years of rapport with her, of checking in with her, going to her Thanksgivings, et cetera, to the point where her former assistant had reached out asking if she would like, I'd like to replace her and work for Janine. And at that time, she was working on a show called Claws that's on TNT.
Right.
And after that,
that's Lucy Nash or something, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was just hustling after that. Okay. But of course, you know, that's just the hustle. You got to have the talent or you have to have the story to it. I think the lesson I learned working on Janine's desk by myself was that the best stories are the stories that scares people, scares your parents, scares people around you, stuff that people shouldn't talk about. But those are what the stories really sell. And it turns out that this one script I had wrote that was I was very self-conscious about was the script that made her feel like, okay, Christian Greer's a writer. Let me put him in a room.
So you
and
just took
the rest is history after that.
Okay. So let me ask both of you guys. Being black writers in Hollywood, is it the same as being black actors in that it's very difficult to get that, you know, to get things to write and shows to write for? Or does it really, or is there a color code there at all?
I would argue that it's even harder being a black writer in Hollywood because it's less about image and really, really more like about, you know, especially if you are trying to get staffed on a TV show as like a writer, it's really about relationships. And mm-hmm. it's about the showrunners, the agents, the managers, and a lot of people that make it in like Hollywood have connections or their dad like owns something or know somebody. But I learned when I moved out here, like, obviously, a lot of black writers don't have that. We don't have those connections coming in to like agencies and showrunners. So we as writers have to really build ourselves up. And yeah. where I feel like with actors, you're able to go to theater school and maybe have like a certain look that attracts people and you're right. doing plays. But when it comes to scripts, it's about not only what's on the page, but our relationships, though.
So do you guys have like a black writers union? Like, you know, like at schools, you have like the black student union. Do you guys have like a black writers union in Hollywood where you guys, you know, you build each other up, you network each other out, that kind of thing?
I mean, I would say in school, when I was in the college at Webster, I mean, we had very few black people in like the film school, TV school there. But I would say out here in Hollywood, I have been able to really build things up with other black writers,
awesome. Okay.
Producers, directors, execs. So, but that took some years, though. It took some years.
Going on top of that, there was, I was lucky coming out here. Going back to what Darren said, there wasn't really much that community in school or high school, whatsoever. It wasn't until when I came out here, there was actually this new group that was formulated called the Black Gay Brunch. And what it contained was, it was all of these black artists from all different kinds of aspects of entertainment coming together bi-monthly, just checking in on each other, what projects they're working on, okay. and just getting to know each other, which was a fantastic group at that time. And this is, of course, this is all through the pandemic. Of course, the pandemic kind of just messed everything up. But right. That's how it came out.
So when you're writing, are you writing for the characters or are the characters forming to what you write? I guess when you have a pilot, right, are you writing based on what the directors tell you they need for this character, or are the characters kind of conforming to what you write? Like, what comes first, the chicken or the egg in that situation?
I mean, I would say when I write, one, I write with what I feel like is going to be, like, entertaining.
Okay.
And I write for what's going to excite me, excite the audience, and what feels authentic.
Okay.
What about you, Christian?
Yeah, I mean, look, I go back to what I said earlier. I think what's the most entertaining thing are the things that people don't know about, and what usually the people don't know about are the secrets you hide. So if you can somehow put entertainment in the secrets in,
right.
if you know how to put a story that you don't want your parents to know about and put it in the script and be like, wow, now that's the story you want to create. You write, you know, write from the heart, write what scares you. That's what I put on the paper first. That's how I lead.
Yeah.
So this strike, right, it's not the first one. I remember the one in 2007. This strike, when you guys strike, you make a lot of people nervous because, you know, reruns cost money, you know. So who decides, listen, we're not getting what we want, we're going on strike? Like, how is that call made?
Okay. So, a nutshell, so I would say every 15 to 30 years in Hollywood, there are there's a major like Hollywood strike, and it's normally the writers. There was a writer strike with the Writers Guild in 1960. It was one in 1988, one in like 07, and this one now. So the people that decide on a strike are the memberships. So anytime, you know, we feel like, oh, we're not getting the right wages or benefits or anything, or we're not being treated the right, the leaders of the union will sit down with Universal and Paramount, every studio, and see if they can work out a deal. And like, our deals are up every 3 years.
Okay.
Now, the reason why there's normally a strike every 15 to 30 years is because business changes. So
What do you mean by that?
So, for instance, in 1960, there was a strike because the television had exploded and writers wanted residuals, like, et cetera.
Gotcha.
TV had been like around for maybe 13 years, like, or so.
Gotcha.
So then when there was a strike in 1988, that one happened because VHS had exploded.
Okay.
So, again, technology. And then in 2007, that, like, happened because DVDs, Blu-rays came, and shit was being put on the internet.
Okay.
TV shows were.
Right, right.
And now, finally, we are in 2023, and what has happened now?
Streaming.
Streaming.
Right.
So now, we strike.
So
and to take a step back from all of that, you know, before in 2007, we had million-dollar companies, studios running the business. Now we have trillion-dollar companies running our business.
Okay.
Studios are investing nearly $19 billion on building streaming, and that's up $5 billion from 2019. You know, industry revenue is topping over $220 billion last year, and almost $30 billion entertainment profits from each year from 2017 to 2021. We're talking about companies that put child labor in another country, a company that built another manufacturer that people committed suicide. These are the people that we're trying to negotiate that are hiring less writers for the same amount of time to make the same TV shows that we're making 15 years ago. They're paying less and making us overworked, so just like those people across the country, and they're getting away with it.
So, as I understand it, it's a dispute about the residuals from the streaming media. Is that about right?
So, yeah. So, residuals are a huge, huge, huge issue.
Okay.
But there's also, like, issues around the compensation. Writer pay has declined 23% since 2007. But the profits are up, though. Last year, the studios made $29 billion in profits, yet the writer pay fell. But budgets are, like, also up for TV shows and feature.
What's the explanation for writer's pay falling? Like, I don't understand that. I can understand it maybe staying the same if they don't want to give you a raise. But how does it fall?
They hire less writers. They hire less writers. You know, let me take it back. Normally, for a TV show that has 10 episodes,
right,
they hire about maybe 12 writers in a room, and they go for about 20 weeks to write all 10 of those episodes, right? We are now living in a time where that same studio is now only going to hire 4 writers and only give them 12 weeks to write those same amount of episodes.
Oh, jeez.
Yep.
Okay.
So,
I got you.
Like, I will give you an example. So, when I got my first job in 2018 on The Clause, I was hired in as, like, a writer. I was in that writer's room for about 35 weeks. Now, that's very rare for writers to be, like, able to work for 35 straight weeks.
Okay.
You are lucky to be able to work 8 weeks a year.
Yeah.
Really?
As a TV writer. Yeah. Now,
what?
This is why a lot of folks have to write TV stuff, feature stuff, podcasts, direct, acts, like, et cetera. Because writers aren't being hired as much anymore for multiple weeks like we used to.
So I don't want to dig into you guys' pockets, right? I mean, I really, really don't. But like my listeners, I'm curious, like, what kind of money are we talking about? If you're only working 8 weeks out of the year, like, what are you getting paid for those 8 weeks? I mean, who survives off of that?
It really, really depends on your level as, like, a writer.
Okay.
Now, if you are a staff writer, you're making about $4,500 to $5,000 a week in those 8 weeks. If you are a mid-level writer, per episode, you're likely making about 20,000 to 30,000 like a pop, which if you get hired to write 8 like episodes,
right,
you can do that math there.
Right, right.
And then obviously if you are an upper level writer, you are commanding 40,000, 50, even like higher per like episode.
Per episode.
So it's good money, but as they always say, when you make more, you spend more. So people are, you know, buying homes, paying for school for their kids, etc. So,
and none of it's guaranteed. For
right, none of it is guaranteed because shows get canceled like
all
every
the
day.
Time. Right.
Deals die. It's just
Yeah, and they give you like reality check. Like pretend like I'm that kid this year. I just got to my very first show as an being an assistant. You know, a normal assistant pay is about 45K a year. You know, subtract the tax that you have to pay in for that. So maybe that's like 35 in your pocket. All right, so I got to my big show. I'm the only staff writer in the size of 5 writers. They're only going to keep me there for 8 weeks. 5K, that's $40,000. Now, take word that every writer has a representation, which means they have a manager and maybe a lawyer on top of that.
Right.
So that $40,000 that you just made in that new show, that you don't know what's going to have a second season, so you don't know if you're going to have a job after this. 5% goes to the lawyer of that 40K.
Right.
Another 10% goes to your representation. Now subtract also the tax you're losing from that, right? So how much money are you really making in those 8 weeks? Was it 30K?
Under 30K.
And you don't even know if you're going to have a job now. Yeah, you don't even going to have a job yet. Are you going to have a job? It's going to be highly doubtful because everybody else is fighting tooth and nail to be on a show where they're not hiring the same amount of writers they used to last time.
Not to mention you're in L.A.
Yep. Oh, adding the cherry to the cake.
Yeah. So, and you guys chose this. Nobody held a gun to your head, right?
Oh, yeah.
You guys chose this risky profession, right?
Oh, yeah.
Well, so besides the money, besides the residuals from streaming, which it sounds like you definitely deserve, what else are you guys wanting? How is your health care? Do you guys get a pension? I mean, how is that working for you?
So we get amazing like health care. However, in order to maintain it, you must make at least 42,000 like every year. And if you aren't getting great residuals, or if you're not selling things like every year, or if you're not staffed on a show, it's hard to make that. So right now, though, the other issues that we are fighting for is that, so like half of the writers guild right now is working at scale, and what that means is every union has the bare minimum that writers make. And so however, you have people now who have been doing this for 20 years and they are making the exact same as someone that's only been doing this for 2 years. Like, that's not right. Like,
right,
experience, you should be making more. And it didn't used to be like that. And there are folks who, you know, have been writing feature films for many, many years.
Right.
And now they are only making $50,000 per script. People used to be making $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 and up per feature film as like a writer.
Wow.
That's almost unheard of.
Wow.
Now.
So when you...
And lastly, AI is something else that is coming up. These streamers and these studios want to start using robots to write scripts, pitches, books, like etc. And they just expect us to just sit there and rewrite that shit. And it's like, no, we have to have some rules for something like that.
Well, that's what I was going to ask
about
this whole artificial intelligence thing that I'm seeing that's being put in the mix here. And I did want to try to understand how that affects you guys. So I'm glad you're talking about it. So could you expound on that a little bit more?
Yeah, so listen, long story short, what the studios and streamers are hoping is that they'll be able to use a robot to write a quick script, and then they can hire like us writers to rewrite it very fast and very cheap.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with all of this is that robots don't have soul.
Right.
They don't understand nuance, you know, humor,
right.
Character stuff. It's like, no, we're not doing that. Like, stop it. So, I mean, Christian, do you have, like, anything to
add? Yeah, like, you know, it's going back to the what I was saying, that they're hiring less writers. Now AI is coming in, right? So there he is like, oh, wait, we don't need to hire all these writers anymore. Yep. All we need is one writer and one machine. And how devastating would that be? You're looking at, look, there's about just under 12,000 writers in the union that write TV shows, foreign TV shows. We're looking at a world possibly where they are thinking, we only need 400 writers for these 400 shows and one machine with it, putting all the rest of the writers trying to find a new career, which is devastating to hear.
But it doesn't make any sense, Christian. I mean, how do you program creativity? I don't understand. Like, I don't understand how that's even possible.
That's the problem. What they're doing is, look, the scary part, the studios are already exploring this. And what they're doing right now is they're taking IP, and IP means as novels that have been made, they're looking to market. They're putting these novels into the machine and telling the AI, hey, rewrite this as a script. It's going to come out as a shitty script, which is why they're going to hire a top-tier writer. Hey, can we write this to give the human emotion for it? We're not going to pay you for the full script. We're going to pay you for a rewrite,
wow,
which is half the price.
That is horrible.
Yep. That part,
that's horrible.
So we will not tolerate that. We will not tolerate that. I will tell you right now. And that's one of the main reasons we are on strike right now.
So has this been done already? Is this just a concept, or is this something that you've seen done?
This is already undergoing behind closed doors right now with the studios, as a fact. They publicly said they are exploring it right now. And the whole idea is, from what they're saying, they're going to present writers with these computer-generated scripts for rewrites already. They've already spoken about it.
I don't understand how that
would.
I don't know. I don't know what to say about it. I don't understand how that would work. Because the concept of a script, right, comes from, like you said, Darren, the soul. It comes from from creativity. I don't understand how, because what you're saying is an AI would take a script from a book, right? It would take a book and create a script from that book, right? So who gets credit for that? Who gets credit for that? Does the initial author or writer? You know what I mean? Like, how does that work?
That's what we're trying to regulate.
I mean, the main, like, issue here is that, yes, this is a business. It's entertainment. Writing is a business. But the main issue here is that these companies are no longer seeing writing as an art.
Right.
They are seeing it as a tacky garage sale. Like, let's just hurry up and get it done and get it out the door. That's not how writing works. It's an art. You have to think like about it.
But doesn't ratings play into this? Like, don't they pay attention? I mean, ratings is what pays the bills. So if you have, you know, if you have, I don't know what else to call it, but if you have shit that you're giving to the public, and the ratings are dropping, wouldn't it suggest that perhaps this AI thing isn't it's not working? You know what I mean?
Yeah. You would think, right?
You would think. The unfortunate part is that they haven't been able to test that out yet, and we don't
want
them.
And you don't want them to. Gotcha. By that time, it's too late. Yeah, I got you. Man, crazy. So how's it looking? Do you think you guys are making headway? How's it looking for you guys?
Look, it's going to be a long journey, I feel. I feel it's beautiful to see us all out there. I've been out there all week this week. Beautiful people, black and brown people, picketing the line. And look, it only takes two people to form a line. And we've this all this solidarity from all the communities of Hollywood. We're talking Teamsters. Teamsters are the people that drive all the production vehicles that have all the equipment.
Oh, wow.
If they see that picket line, they will turn around and not go into
that
the set.
That is awesome.
And because of that, we've been able to successfully shut down shoots after shoots after shoots. And it's becoming, you know, amazing and beautiful. It's like, how can you imagine? Think of any other cause that you can just wake up, get out of your bed, grab a picket sign, and make a picket line with another friend and prevent a production happening for the sake of solidarity of protecting all unions. Yeah. Like, I can't think of another cause of just, you know, grabbing a picket and just doing that. And it is fantastic.
And I was going to ask how the solidarity was going, and it sounds like it's going well.
Yeah. I mean, we have, like, the SAG, the Screen Actors Guild are out there. The Directors Guild people are out there. All the unions in Hollywood are out there picketing along with us, because it's not just us that our contracts are up. Their contracts are coming up, too. In fact, as we speak right now, the Directors Guild of America are negotiating their contracts for residuals as we speak. And they could have a potential strike at the end of June if things don't add up. And also next month, Screen Actors Guild are having their negotiations renegotiated for their residuals, and they have a lot of things that they want to discuss, AI being one of them. So they could be on strike too. It's all a domino effect right now. We were just the first ones to start a negotiation that didn't go well.
Yeah. So I will say this, how things are looking right now. The 1960 strike lasted for 22 weeks, so about over 4 months. The 1981 strike lasted 3 months. The 88 strike lasted about 153 days. The 07 strike lasted 100 days. So what I'm getting at here is that the average strikes usually take anywhere from 90 to like 150-something days. That's what history has shown us.
Okay. And how are you guys faring? Do you guys... let me ask you this question, and I've always been curious about this. If you're writing for one show, right, are you allowed, do you, like, sign a non-compete that you can't write for another show similar to it? Like, are you only allowed to contract for one show to write for?
Well, I mean, if you are staffed on a show, you can only write for that show at one time. However, as you move up and get more experience while you're writing on a show, you can develop your own shows and movies and podcast and all that, you know, kind of fun stuff too. But yeah, they only let us write for one show at a time.
Okay. I was always curious about that. This is fascinating stuff, man. I wish you guys all the best. I mean, I can't even imagine what's going to happen. And I said that I had this conversation with a friend of mine the other day about AIs and how it's going to be the demise of the human race. We're creating things to replace us in every facet of life. And once we start creating things that can have a soul, even if it's an artificial one, and can think for itself, we're done. So I hope and I pray that the brakes are put on that whole concept, to be honest with you.
Yeah. And I will say this, like, we will get like a deal. We like always do. I mean, we had a few years back, we had a very, very like ugly fight with our agents. Every single writer in Hollywood fired their agents, and it took us almost 2 years to get like a deal, but we got it. Now, I don't think this strike will be that long. I really, really doubt that, but we are always willing to fight for what's right. And the Writers Guild will always stand up when we see some fuck shit. And I mean, I've been a captain in the Writers Guild now for like 5 years.
Okay.
So I was around during the big like agency strike in 2019, and it was like scary times, and people were just like, oh man, we're going to lose like our agents. And we eventually got like a deal, then obviously they resolved the prior strikes from 07 and beyond. So this will get settled. It's just that we are asking for a lot, and it's going to take some time to some things out. And obviously there are a lot of layoffs and mergers and all that other shit going on right now too. So it's just like, So that's, yeah, wow. That's where we are.
Well, listen.
Just gotta wear a raincoat is what they say. Make sure you have a raincoat on.
Well, look, I've learned a lot. A whole lot, man. And my listeners have learned a whole lot. And I'm rooting for you guys, praying for you guys from here in Baltimore, as I'm sure my listeners are around the world. And I'll be keeping my eye open. And if you guys don't mind, if you guys are open to coming back, once you get what you want and talking about what you've won or what you've been awarded, that you've earned, I'd be so happy if you would do that for me. Because I'm going to call you again just to let you know.
1,000%.
Okay.
Yeah, I love it. Only if you let me come in to promote my book, too.
Oh, absolutely, man. Tell me what it is.
Well, I have been working on a book for about 4 years now. It's a book about kink and shame and sex lives and relationships, and I've interviewed over 50 people now their, you know, kinks and just everything. So it's a very comedic kind of sex book that's been really, really fun. So, and this is something that's never really been done by a black man either. So it's something.
You threw me a curve. I ain't gonna lie to you. You kind of threw me. That's not what I was expecting. I wasn't expecting that.
It's really.
You got to put your blinker on, man. You're gonna churn lanes like that, bro. Like,
listen, I'm gonna tell you right now. The very first show I worked on was Claws, and that's a very sexually charged kind of ratchet show, and that's kind of the stuff that like I write. So,
right.
Yeah, listen, yeah.
Well, look, man.
Yeah, it's a fascinating book because it really deconstructs what we were taught, what was not normal.
Yeah.
In sex lives and what is normal. It's deconstructing it and formulating what the new generation is walking into, or how they're reconstructing of what sexuality is and what love is and what sex is.
Well, listen, no shame in my game. I got to be honest too, Darren, when you first started talking about, you said you were a kid, you know, you had an interest like in adult films. I mean, you cleaned it up. You went on to explain what you meant by that. But I'm like, what the hell? And then you come all the way back around, and you start talking about kink.
I probably should have said like R-rated, like adult film, maybe. But I just realized that too. Yeah.
I'm like, all right, now where the hell is this show going to go? Like, where do I go from here?
I love it. But yeah, no, I'm very open in this book, like about, I saw Basic Instinct for the first time when I was maybe 9, and I ain't been right since. So that's where it all kind of started. Yeah.
Well, look, man, you guys are great. Again, we're all rooting for you. I'm going to have you back. We're going to talk about your book when you're done with it, Darren. And you guys, thank you so much for coming on today and being so candid with me, okay?
Thank you.
I really appreciate it.
All right. Now, again, you are now official members of the 1500 family, and we'll be talking to you soon.
All right. Thanks so much, Brian.
All right. Take care, guys. All right. Bye-bye. All right. Bye-bye. Well, I know you hear the music, and that can only mean one thing, just like it always only means one thing on this show. And that means it's time for the Petty. Let's give the Petty a call, see what he's got dialed up for us this week.
Brother B, good morning to you.
Good morning to you, Mr. Petty. How you doing, brother?
I'm doing fantastic. And I would like to say happy Mother's Day to all the mothers out there that happen to be listening to your show this morning.
Absolutely. I had to drop that in too. So happy Mother's Day from the both of us.
Brother B, let me tell you something. Boy, oh boy, Thursday was a big day for the NFL as they dropped those schedules. Man, there's going to be some. But you know what? I can't wait. I'm excited. I can't wait for the season to start. You know, I was kind of surprised what the opening game will be. But then again, you know what? That kind of tells me something because all I'm going to do is I'm going to tell you about game number one. Okay. And it might be a barn burner. I'm talking about the Super Bowl champions at home.
Okay.
First game of the season.
Okay.
Playing against those pesky Lions. Yeah, you know how much I like those boys. So
did they ramp up? Did they vamp up their defense this year, the Lions?
Oh boy, did they ever! And I'm gonna tell you something. Talking about their defense, that young man, Aiden Hutchinson,
right
on that defense, man, he's something else. He's something special. He really is. And you know, like I said, I like that team. At first, I was thinking, well, you know, I don't know. Lions, Chiefs, I don't know. But then I started thinking, they gave some people a run last year. Yeah, they really did. So, yeah, that's the one I'm going to look at. And like I said, I look at a lot of other games. And man, I'm just excited. I can't wait. Yeah. I can't wait for the season to start. You know, speaking of Thursday, the NFL schedule drops. And there was a big disappointment up in this area Thursday evening as those 76ers with the MVP, Joel Embiid, having a golden opportunity to close out the Celtics. And I'm telling you, man, they ready to just tear stuff up here in Philly. You know, close out game six. They're saying Doc Rivers can't get it done. You know,
Harden
the MVP
is hot
is
and cold,
to take
man.
Over.
Harden is hot and cold.
Well, you know, Harden's Harden. You know, what do you expect? But see, if you looked at that game, Brother B, you had to say, why isn't Joel Embiid taking over at the end? Because Boston was almost begging the Sixers, please put us out of our misery. Tatum wasn't doing anything. He wasn't doing anything for three quarters. He didn't do anything. Jason Tatum was ice cold. It's like he didn't even care. Then all of a sudden, the fourth quarter, he woke up. He outscored the Sixers himself. The Sixers only scored 13 points in the fourth quarter. He scored 16.
Yeah, but people ride Tatum's jock. But Jaylen Brown is the person that gives the Sixers a really hard time on that squad. Jaylen Brown is a killer, a silent assassin on that team.
That may be true, but I'm telling you, when it all was all said and done, Jason Tatum was lighting them up. And, you know, I listened to the press conference after the game, and to hear Joel Embiid just throw his teammates under the bus was just hard. I mean, if you're the MVP, if you're the guy, if you're the man, somewhere online, you're calling the timeout. You're telling Doc Rivers, tell them to get me the ball. He's supposed to take his big 7-foot dot, down in the paint and just dominate Al Horford. And it just wasn't happening.
I got to, you know, here's my take on that, though. He is 7 foot. He is 300 pounds. And he's running the floor for almost the entire game. I mean, and he's playing defense. He's playing offense. He's dribbling. He's shooting outside. He's working inside. He's getting fouled and hacked. That's a lot. He's carrying a lot of pressure, especially when everybody else around him is hot and cold.
Brother B, I know we usually talk about football, but we're going to talk a little bit about the NBA right here. We watch a lot of NBA games in our time. We watch a lot of playoff games in our time.
Right.
We watch a lot of championships in our times.
Right.
When crunch time came around, do you think LeBron is not going to be shooting the ball in the last 3 or 4 minutes of a game on a closeout game?
No, I know.
You think Kobe is not going to be shooting the ball in the last 3 or 4 minutes of a closeout game? Do you think Magic is not going to get the ball to Kareem or one of his high scores in a closeout game? And we're not even going to talk about Mike. We're not even going to talk about him in a closeout game in the last 3 or 4 minutes of a game.
No, so, you're right. You're right about all of that. But I'm talking about the physical makeup of the players that you just spoke about. None of those guys are 7 feet. None of those guys were doing both the guard work, the shooting guard work, and the inside man work. Now, Magic did it a couple times. Well, he did it in a championship playoff game. But he didn't have to do it every single night. You know what I'm saying?
Brother B, we're talking about a closeout game. You are the MVP of the league. Nobody else is doing anything. And it's like you have to man up. Look, I'm the man. This is my team. Give me the ball. Okay. Not say, well, you know, I wasn't touching the ball in the last year. Come on, dude. Come on. You know, and I'm telling you right now, people in Philadelphia are not happy. They've lost a lot of faith in them. I mean, you heard him whine and cry about not getting the MVP last year. You almost seem like he whined and cried about it, that they gave it to him this year.
Right.
And now here's you're in your house.
Your defining moment.
And now, where are you? You disappear. So, but you know what? let's move right along and talk about some guys that you know I like. I'm talking about, and I'm telling you, you really have to be a baseball fan to watch those high-flying Orioles. I watched them last Sunday against Atlanta,
right?
Who's hot?
Yes, they
are the second best team in the league behind those super duper hot Rays. And I'm telling you, the Orioles gave them all they could handle last weekend.
I didn't watch any of the games. I'm being honest, none of them.
Yeah, I'm telling you, Brother B, last Sunday, it went into extra innings. It was fantastic. It was some good pitching, some good defense. That game was fantastic. And I'm telling you right now, I'm telling you, Baltimore, you got to keep those eyes on the O's. If you check the standings, yes, they're in second place. Yes, they're behind the Rays. But if you look at all of the standings and you look at their record and compare them to other teams in the American League, other teams in the National Leagues, they are in the top three.
Oh,
not
wow.
The top five, not the top 10, but the top three. And that says a lot because the number one team is in the same division as the Orioles. So it says a lot about the Orioles.
Yeah, it does.
You got to watch those guys. You got to watch those guys, man. I'm telling you. And we don't have to mention the XFL. You know, that's a foregone conclusion. It was a foregone conclusion
at the beginning of the season.
Yeah. Congratulations. Need to be, you know, given out to those defenders. They did what they had to do. You know, it's no big thing. It's not even worth talking about. And right now, the USFL, I'm talking about, it's up for grabs. You know, it seemed like a team would emerge being the best of the best, and it's just a free fall. I'm thinking, you know what, Brother B, and I said this earlier a couple of shows ago, that
right.
It would be nice because both of these leagues play in the spring. If they could have a championship game between the USFL team and the XFL team, I think that would be fantastic. I didn't realize there was so much talent, even though the USFL looked like there's a better brand of ball being played.
There is.
There's a lot of talent in the XFL because a lot of these guys, more and more guys, are now starting to get tryouts with NFL teams.
Right.
And, you know, with that being said, mini camp starts next month.
Can't wait.
For the NFL. I can't wait. I'm telling you, the schedule is looking hot. Unfortunately, the team that has the toughest schedule this year will not be going back to the Super Bowl. Now, I'm talking about those Philadelphia, yes, I said it, Philadelphia Eagles. They have the toughest schedule in the NFL. And we're going to see if they will, for real, or they were a bunch of frauds last year with that record. Because they're going to be playing some tough teams this year.
Well, in 10 seconds, tell me who you have right now going to the Super Bowl based on the draft.
Based on the draft?
Mm-hmm.
Man, that's a toughie, Brother B. Going to the Super Bowl, I do honestly believe that this might be the year that Buffalo represents the AFC. And I'm going to take a long shot here and say I think those guys from the Golden Gate City will be playing those Bills.
I believe that
finally Chris Berman, the original Swami, will get his wish for seeing a Buffalo Bills San Francisco 49ers Super Bowl.
Okay.
Now, the Ravens will somewhere be there in the mix, but they will not be going to the Super Bowl. I'm sorry to say it, but I do expect them to be the playoff team. They're ranked right now as the eighth best team in the league, so they're going to make some noise, and they're going to upset some people.
Yeah, they're going to upset a lot of people, no doubt about it.
So, look, Brother B, I got to get out of here. I got to go. I'm going to catch some USFL games, you know, watch a little bit of Oreo baseball, watch a little Philly baseball, and find out who's going to make it to the NBA Finals.
Good games, brother.
Enjoy your day, Brother B. Talk to you next week. I'm out of here. Peace.
All right, peace, brother. Take care. Well, there you have it from the Petty. Always good to hear from him. And I cannot wait until the NFL season starts to see what the Ravens are going to do. I got, you know, Lamar has weapons now. He's got weapons to throw to other than a tight end. And I can't wait to see what he does with it. And all we have is about 97 days left to find out what he does. Also, I want to thank my guests again, Christian Greer and Darren Dorch out in California, out in Hollywood, for joining me today and dropping the dimes that they dropped about this writer strike. I really and truly hope that they get what they want, what they're asking for, because they definitely deserve it. Hey, and remember, hit me on IG at On with Brian Pettaway. I want to hear what you think of today's show, about the interview. If you have any feedback of what the writers are going through and what you expect from them to get, just let me know. I love to hear from you. Always the feedback. Also want to say happy Mother's Day to all the mothers out there. I want to send a special shout out to Aunt Clara, who remembers me from a little man, from a little kid. And I got to tell you, you know, mothers are all over the place. They've got their eye on you. They're watching you. And she was one of those who remembers me. So happy Mother's Day, Aunt Clara. I promise you I'll come to see you soon. Everybody else out there, have an amazing Sunday. Take it easy. Do nothing today. Celebrate time with your moms or remembering your mother. And then tomorrow, wake up and conquer the world. Because like I always say, the best thing about doing nothing is you can quit whenever you want. Again, happy Mother's Day, mothers. I'm out of here. Peace.